Welcome to The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. We begin our program this week with a visit to a printmaking studio at the Maryland Institute College of Art. The walls are lined with drawers full of methodically arranged typesetting blocks, and down the middle of the room is a row of mechanical Vandercook proof presses. In 2010, Micah purchased this venerable setup for teaching purposes, and in the process, rescued an endangered chapter of Baltimore history, Globe Poster Company. The Signal's Aaron Hankin brings us the story.
The clanking of this press meant one thing. There was a big show in town, and Globe Poster was about to let you know it.
Fats Domino, James Brown, Ike and Tina Turner, Muddy Waters, Joe Tex, Joe Simon, Marvin Gaye.
Bold black fonts, letterpressed onto silkscreen backgrounds, a fluorescent green and yellow and purple and orange. When you see a Globe poster, somehow you just know it, even if you don't know why. You can't help but pay attention to the pure visual loudness in front of you. And that's the point. For 80 years, Globe Poster was a bustling print shop in East Baltimore. It was the go-to place for big-time promoters with touring acts on the road. Back in the R&B heyday of the 1950s and 60s, show posters flew off the presses, into shipping boxes, out to cities across the eastern U.S., and up onto telephone poles, shop windows, and anywhere else they might happen to catch your eye. It all started when four guys got to talking over a card game. They decided to go into the poster business. They just needed to figure out where to set up shop.
So what they did, they got a map out of the eastern part of the United States and folded it in half horizontally. And the line went right through Baltimore. So they said this would be a good central East Coast city to work in.
That's Frank Cicero. He and his brother Bob worked the shop for half a century. Their dad started there just a few years after the place opened in 1929, back when Globe Poster's clientele were mainly traveling carnivals.
Of course, in 1929, as we all know, was the year of the stock market crash. And the carnival was the poor man's way of entertaining his family. So that was really the crux of why the company started so rapidly during the Depression.
Frank Cicero says in those early decades, Globe Poster's business went from brisk to breakneck with the advent of two things, the rise of R&B music and the invention of Day-Glow ink.
Our posters really became extremely popular during the 50s. We really made our posters stand out more than any others. Years ago, there were either solid background colors or a rainbow color on the background of the poster. What we did, we brought in day glow or fluorescent colors.
The operating aesthetic was simple. Make the posters loud and legible.
If a person couldn't read it in 3 seconds, it wasn't worth it.
They weren't meant to be set up there for you to take a look at and say, oh my God, it's so beautiful.
Bob Cicero is Frank's younger brother.
Most of the people that saw it were either on the street or actually driving past it. And you know, as you go down the road, you're doing 30 miles an hour. You don't have a lot of time. So that's why all our type was fairly bold and big, because you got that split second. What's so good about our posters is that it's there in your face every day. If you go down to a street very similar to like Liberty Road, I think at one time said you'd see 30 or 40,000 cars a day. Well, you put one poster up, 30 or 40,000 people are going to see it.
Bob sifts through drawers upon drawers of wooden blocks, letters of all shapes and sizes, decorative hearts and stars. And then there are the zinc and copper plates etched with faces.
Here's a James Brown. Here is a purple that we used to James Brown. This is the background. This here is the lettering that was done in black of James Brown. And this is the picture of James Brown.
The Globe Poster Company was headquartered in Baltimore, but the orders came in from everywhere east of the Rockies.
In the day before faxes and emails and that kind of thing, most of the orders were taken over the phone. We did a lot of blues, so a lot of our orders came from the South, New Orleans, Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia.
Know your man I'm gone. Know your man I'm gone. Know your man I'm gone. Down to the county farm and got his shackles on.
The promoters are the ones that really called us, the guy that was promoting the show. And he would call me and give me the information. I would do the layout and also design where the cuts would go. And by cut, I mean the photo of the artist, if we had a photo on hand for him.
After the layout was done and the type was set, it was set up all in wood type. It gets locked up. It goes up on a press. They pull a black and white proof of it. And once the black and white proof is there, then you go back and you actually add your colors for the backgrounds. And then from there, we would take it back over to the press room, which actually did the first proof, and actually print the black on top. Because you wanted the black on top instead of the color on top.
They trusted us with the design of the poster.
They knew what our style was. They knew how we played the game. And we did it for so doggone long, you know. And so the one thing they wanted was clarity, colors stand out in your face, and that's what they loved. They loved that bold colors and the way they actually would grab people. In my hand right now, I have a coin key, and these are called coins, and it's Q-U-O-I-N-S. And actually, these are like little wedges, and you actually turn them to the one way or the other. You either open them or close them. And this actually pushes all the type to one side. You're actually putting coins on two sides, one on the bottom and one on the side, and that locks everything up. So the keys are like this. I separate it, I actually bring them together. And then that's not my back, that's actually the wood type actually moving. This is of Aretha when she was, I don't know the age, maybe 20, 22. 1985. We always put the date in the back.
From WYPR in Baltimore, this is The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. If you're just joining us, we're visiting with Frank and Bob Cicero of Baltimore's Globe Poster Company. It's a family print shop that supplied the entertainment industry with event posters across the eastern U.S. for 80 years. When the historic company was about to go out of business, a portion of Globe Poster's equipment and archives was purchased by the Maryland Institute College of Art in 2010. It lives on now as a teaching tool for art students and a functional press that's recently done projects for the Lincoln Center, the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall, and the Smithsonian Institution. Bob Cicero teaches in the reconstructed shop once a week, and his older brother Frank also drops in for special guest visits. It's a pretty relaxed pace nowadays compared to the frantic schedule these guys maintained for so many years.
On a slow day, it's probably 8 to 10 show posters. On a busy day, it would be 20 show posters.
Right around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if the guys saw me in the back in the shop, they would get a little nervous because I would always have to say, well, this has to go tonight, this has to go tonight.
With Frank, everything had to go. No matter what it was, he promised everything. That was his big problem.
I used to put on the bottom of a layout, rush, and then sometimes we'll put rush, rush, rush.
So I would always ask, well, what's the difference between rush and hot rush or hot, hot, hot rush? He could never give me what that time limit was.
I'll tell you how it started. When I would put rush down, nobody would pay attention to it after a while.
Well, so then I would everything put, was rush.
So then I would put hot rush, and that worked for a little while. And then I said, well, I better add another something to it. So then I would put hot, hot rush, rush. I mean, it would go on and on and on. So
he had more copy on Hot Rush than he actually had on the poster for who was going to be on the show. It was bad.
Miami, Florida! Atlanta, Georgia!
I'm interested in hearing what you guys have to say about the fact that these very functional pieces that were created to be, you know, the most efficient advertising possible have come to be, like, respected as works of art. What did you make of it when people started appreciating them that way?
Well, you know, we started looking at them differently. Of course, that was just fairly recently. I mean, during the heyday, first of all, we didn't have time to think about, oh, is this a work of art? We only thought of it as, we have to get this job done, and we have to make sure that this poster is going to help our customer get the people in for this particular event. So that was really what was on our mind. We never considered it to be a work of art.
Our emphasis was always to get the posters out quick and to do the best you could. I didn't worry about anything else. So I never thought of it as artwork because it wasn't on the top of my list. My top of my list was the guy paid for the posters, he needs them. These are actually the, you know, kind of some of the visual language, some of the artwork that was done. And then what happens is we have this "the," and it's actually a script writing. And instead of us set and type up "the," which takes time, wood type and everything, we take this block, which has the word already done, and just put it right in a form, and it's done.
Here's a block here that says the word "band" in the reverse, meaning that the color black would be around the word and the actual letters would be in white.
Space, it means a lot. We would always tell people, please take out everything you can and just put the emphasis, because it's a poster. It's not a brochure which you can sit and read and talk about. It's a poster. It's got to be seen quick and fast. Wow. So the least amount of words, the better off you are. The Gospels were the worst. They would have like 6 or 8 or 10 acts, so you had to fit everything in. And I never forget this one customer says, well, you got to put this, you know, we had this and we had so much to put in it and we had to put this name in there. And I said, my God, I said, another name. And I said, what is this name for? He says, well, that name is the custodian. And I said, well, why are we putting him in there? He says, well, if we put his name on there, he'll do clean the place up for free. And I said, oh, God.
When you ask Frank Cicero what brought about the decline of Globe Poster as a business, there's nothing philosophical in his answer, no major cultural shifts or technological advances to point the finger at. The answer is simple: politics.
The local governments, as well as the federal government, wanted to clean up the city, or cities, I should say. And so there were a lot of restrictions put on posters, and they were, after a while, they were totally condemned. That was the beginning of an end of an era.
Business dwindled. Promoters would come into the shop and say, we love the posters, but we're getting $100 fines left and right. We just can't afford to do this anymore. As they say, the writing was on the wall.
I miss the actual working with my hands and doing a layout. I miss that dramatically. And I didn't realize I would miss it so much. And the nice thing about it was that once you design something, within a couple days, you would see the product. And that really, you know, gave me a good feeling.
My whole thing was production. If I could get 10 posters out today and 15 posters out tomorrow, I did everything. A good part of the time I was going crazy, but I just loved it.
In the final days of Globe Poster, the rent was due and the money just wasn't coming in. Frank and Bob Cicero were faced with a painful solution. They could sell off their presses, their signature type blocks, and their poster archives, but that would mean scattering history to the winds. When Micah made the move to purchase Globe Poster nearly intact, it was a dream come true for the Cicero brothers.
Actually, after Micah did the purchase back in 2010, they wanted to continue the tradition of Globe because naturally we had all the posters we'd done. They had a lot of our type, and then they wanted the kids to understand how to put it together. And so I came along with it and actually teaching now once a week and about the style of Globe poster where we screen print and we letterpress. So the tradition is continually going on. We actually show them the ingredients of how to make it like we did, and then they make it into their own style, which is really great, a great way of learning.
The rollers spin on a Vandercook-proof press while Bob Cicero watches one of his students, a Micah illustration major named Bridget Gibson, as she fits a blank poster paper into a set of metal slots.
Right now she's got the rollers actually on. That actually is turning by a motor on the bottom. And you can hear the ink. It's black ink up on the press right now. And I guess she's going to actually roll one down, trip one, and roll it down the down the cylinder.
To watch Bob watching his student is to see a beautifully bittersweet expression. His eyes have the proud, nervous vulnerability of a dad seeing his kid ride a bike for the first time. He's still in charge, but he's learning how to let go.
They love to get their hands dirty, and they really want to get into the thick of things. It was kind of foreign to me because I thought everybody wanted to be a white-collar worker at the point, but not here. They're really into it. It's funny. The faster I teach them, the faster they're learning and the faster they're doing their own thing. And what a great way of inspiration, because I'm teaching them, but they're also teaching me, and it's been great for me.
Globe Poster Shop operators Bob and Frank Cicero, visiting with producer Aaron Henkin at the collection's current home at the Maryland Institute College of Art. You can find a link to Globe at our website, wypr.org. You're listening to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio. After the break, folk music. It's not just for hippies anymore. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Andy Bainstock. When we think about folk music from the 1960s, names like Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and Joan Baez often come to mind. But what about Janet Green, Tony Dolan, and Vera Vanderlaan? These are the lesser-known conservative counterparts to the left-leaning folk heroes of the anti-war movement, and their work has been collected in a new anthology called Freedom is a Hammer, Conservative Folk Revolutionaries of the 60s. Cold War cultural historian Bill Gearhart spoke with producer Lisa Morgan about this obscure musical counterculture.
Bill Gearhart, welcome to The Signal.
Thank you.
Freedom is a Hammer, Conservative Folk Revolutionaries of the 60s, this compilation you've put together. How did this project come about?
Well, a long time ago, back in the 90s, I interviewed Janet Green, who is one of the featured artists on the CD. And I was approached by an Australian label, Omni Recording Corporation, and that person wanted to put together an entire CD of Janet Green's work, but there wasn't enough of her work to fill out the CD. So we decided to focus on two other artists who had put out albums in the 60s that were responding to the liberal folk movement of the 60s. So that's the genesis was the Janet Green interview that I did back in the 90s.
I wasn't aware that there were so many conservative, or that there were conservative folk artists. Everyone thinks of Joan Baez, Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Singing for Peace, and all that. This was sort of a little counter-movement, or what was this?
Right. I wasn't aware of it either until one day I was in a Goodwill in Los Angeles and I found a collection of Janet Green's work in a bin for like a dollar. So I bought it and it was part of a big box set of spoken word polemics about anti-communism. And on one side was Janet Green singing anti-communist folk songs. And it's the only side worth listening to.
What did you think when you heard it?
Well, the first thing I thought was it's incredibly well produced, and the lyrics are just hilarious. And each song mimics a certain genre. Like there's a Calypso song, there's a Tammy Wynette type song, but it's all under the rubric of folk.
And sort of on purpose meant to mimic popular songs that you might be more familiar with, but with alternate universe lyrics about
right.
communists and that sort of thing.
Right. And the man who was Janet Green's Colonel Tom Parker was this gentleman named Fred Schwarz, who headed up this group called the Christian Anti-Communist Crusade. He immediately saw in Janet Green a tool or a weapon in his mind to combat the liberal excesses of the folk world.
Well, maybe we should play a little bit of a snippet from a Janet Green song so that people know what we're talking about. What would be a good example to play for our listeners?
My favorite Janet Green song is Poor Left Winger, because it works in beatniks and communism, and it all fits under this great Tammy Wynette twangy guitar.
I'm just a poor left winger, befuddled, bewildered, forlorn, duped by a bearded singer, peddling his communist corn. In the Cafe Expresso, sounds of guitars could be heard, wanging a plaintive folk song, spreading the communist word. Hair hung around his shoulders, and sandals were on his feet. His shirt tail was ragged, making the picture complete. I followed him off to college, the man that I came to adore, where student demonstrations blocked every classroom door.
That's conservative folk artist Janet Green and her song Poor Left Winger. Now, she was a true believer. What about these artists? Did they really believe in what they were doing? It's easy through the lens of time to listen to this, and it's very entertaining and funny, but she really believed what she was saying, didn't she?
She did at the time, but she had this ability, I think, to turn it all off. She was with the Christian Anti-Communism Crusade for about 3 years, and then she had enough. So in 1967, she decided to try to restart her television career, and that didn't work. So she became a lounge singer for 30 years, and she never sang another anti-communist song in her life.
So she was in it for the moment, I guess.
Right. It was almost like Stockholm Syndrome.
Now, another artist, though, that's featured, Tony Dolan, he seemed like he made a life as a conservative activist. Why don't we talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, Tony Dolan is really interesting. He started his folk career as a teenager. He had a small folk combo, and he would go campaign for Barry Goldwater in 1964. And that grew into a larger career as a folk singer at Yale. One of his mentors was William F. Buckley Jr., who promoted him as a conservative folk singer. And that led to a record contract with Key Records in Los Angeles. Key is kind of a Red Scare record factory. All it churned out was anti-communist records.
Which is an amazing, it's hard, I think we're so far away from that, but it was such a real thing. And it was actually something that destroyed lives. I mean, it's easy to joke about it now, but, you know, the Red Scare, and especially in Los Angeles, was something that affected people in very dark ways. But there was this whole commercial side to popularizing anti-communism that's kind of a fascinating counterculture to the counterculture.
Right. It was not very well noted at the time, but it's the kind of thing that gets rediscovered in Goodwill record bins.
But Tony Dolan went on to have a career in politics, writing for some of the major stars of the conservative movement almost to the present day.
Right. He, after his little career as a folk singer, he became a reporter for a Connecticut newspaper, and he won the Pulitzer Prize,
which is
pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And then he went on to become Ronald Reagan's chief speechwriter for 8 years and wrote the Evil Empire speech in 1983.
Maybe we should listen to a track from him so we know what his singing career was like.
Yeah, I really like Abolish, Abolish. It works in HUAC and all sorts of different anti-communist bugaboos.
We take you now to San Francisco, where thousands of communist-inspired students are leading riots against the House Committee on Un-American Activities, otherwise known as HUAC. We listen closely. We can hear them singing now. Abolish, 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 abolish. That Birch Committee called the UAC. It violates our rights. We cannot sleep at nights. It would even shave my goatee if it could. It calls the commies evil when they're just misunderstood. Abolish, 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 abolish. That Birch Committee called the UAC. It investigates the Nazis and it asks about the commies. Did you ever hear of such brutality? It was used by Richard Nixon. Alger Hiss, our hero, he said so on ABC. Abolish, 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 abolish. That Birch Committee called you.
That's a track by Tony Dolan from the Freedom is a Hammer, Conservative Folk Revolutionaries of the 60s compilation CD. My guest, Bill Gerhart, is responsible in part for this compilation coming to light all these many years later, and he joins me in the studio today. This is 29 songs, so there's a body of work here, but
yes. It
doesn't really go too far beyond this. Is that true? I mean, we've got Vera Vanderland is also on the CD, but you'd almost think there'd be more in a way,
well,
but maybe not.
There is more, but we chose to focus on these three artists because they put out a sustained output of recordings that they wrote themselves. I mean, there are tons of other anti-communist 45s out there, a lot of them protesting the Vietnam War protesters. Of course, Barry Sadler's Ballad of the Green Berets is probably the biggest hit ever. And then you have Victor Lundberg's An Open Letter to My Teenage Son, where he tells his son that if he burns his draft card, he might as well go ahead and burn his birth certificate. That's a favorite. But these are all one-offs.
Now, Vera Vanderland, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
What can you tell me about her? She's the third artist that's featured on this collection.
Yeah, she kind of defied my expectations when I interviewed her, because I had done all sorts of research on her, and I just assumed that she was a Southern or Western artist who, was not really highly educated or anything like that. And she was actually the daughter of a rocket scientist and grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, or Chevy Chase, Maryland, and fell in love with country music on the radio. So she went to a college and met a gentleman, and they fell in love, and they bought a farm in Vermont. And Vera Vanderland was motivated by Ronald Reagan's A Time for Choosing speech and to kind of give it back to the beatniks. She wanted to record music that would provide an answer to the beatniks and the hippies.
Well, what is one of your, what do you like that she's got on this collection?
Keeping on the Reagan theme, she wrote Modern Paul Revere as kind of a love song to Ronald Reagan. So that's worth listening to, I think.
Oh, he's a modern Paul Revere, a modern Paul Revere. Ronald Reagan is the guy who will arouse the countryside. Americans can point with pride to our modern Paul Revere. Way back in 1775, our freedom was at stake. Someone was needed desperately, the people to awake, so that our nation would be born and all men could live free. A man named Paul Revere wrote out the rest is history. Oh, he's a modern Paul Revere, a modern Paul Revere. Ronald Reagan is the guy who will arouse the countryside.
That's Vera Vanderland, one of the featured artists on the Freedom is a Hammer collection of conservative folk music from the 60s. My guest Bill Gerhardt joins me in studio to talk about the collection. We just can't get away from Paul Revere. He just crops up from time to time, doesn't he?
Sarah Palin's favorite.
I guess as a metaphor for American, yeah. That you just don't get much better than that. Well, how is this thing being received? I mean, you get some nice comments. I've seen some wonderful write-ups. It seems like catnip to conservatives these days and also collectors of pop culture.
Yeah, I think the dissonance of the concept of conservative folk music has appealed to certain people. And we got a nice write-up in the New York Times and Rolling Stone and various other publications.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you think about it, it is easy to laugh about the conservative folk. But to be fair, some lefty folk music is pretty corny.
Yeah, that's what appealed to me about conservative folk music, because I've heard Pete Seeger's If I Had a Hammer too many times to tell. So this is a nice counterpoint, and it's refreshing in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, it's been a pleasure talking and listening to this music, and I wish you good luck, and maybe when you've got your project together, you can come back again.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Gerhardt is a Cold War cultural historian whose website, ConnellRad.com, explores all things atomic. Freedom is a Hammer, Conservative Folk Revolutionaries of the 60s, is available from Omni Recording Corporation. For The Signal, I'm Lisa Morgan.
Once it was very weak and once it was small. When it struck upon the world, it wasn't heard at all. But a small band of patriots believed in it so long. They knew that if enough men willed, it would grow big and strong.
You're listening to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. Still ahead, there's an app for that. Justin Sirois imagines a high-tech, on-demand kidnapping service in his novel, So Say the Waiters. That's coming up right after the break. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Andy Beanstock. Have you ever gotten to a point in your life where the tedium of your daily routine drives you to desperation, a point where you just want to escape it all? Baltimore author Justin Sirois has taken that fraught impulse and spun it into a novel called So Say the Waiters. It's the all-too-plausible story of a mobile phone app that answers the call when people say, just take me away. Sirois is here in studio with The Signal's Aaron Henkin.
Justin Sirois, I want to start, I guess, first with the title of this book, So Say the Waiters. Give us a little exposition about who these people are, these waiters, who they're waiting for, and how they've signed themselves up for these rather odd and extreme situations.
The whole book is centered around an app and social network that allows people to kidnap each other, or schedule their own kidnappings, rather. So you sign up for the app, you put it on your phone, you create a profile, and once you submit your kidnap application, within 48 hours, people come get you. So the waiters are the people who have signed up for kidnap, and they're waiting to be taken by the takers.
The waiters and the takers. How in the world did you fall upon this premise for a story? This is fictional, we'll remind people.
It is fictional, but I'll admit that there are a few companies out there that do stuff like this. There's a company in New York that does kind of high-end performance art stuff, and then there's a company in the Midwest that does not so high-end stuff. And I think there's one in the UK. So throughout my research, I did find some people that do fetish things like this, but it's not a social network. It's not an app. And I think that's what makes this particular story special, is that when people download the app, the characters, their entire world changes. All of a sudden, anyone with a cell phone is involved, potentially involved, with the application. So as the characters develop, you understand that their lives are completely turned upside down by the potential of this new thing that's out there.
We'll talk a little bit more about this disturbing theme and its technological implications. But first, let me just ask you to introduce us to a few of the primary characters in this novel. You've got Henry and Danny, a guy and a girl. These are two strangers. They're from two different walks of life, and they're on this very convoluted collision course with each other. Who are these people, and what's propelling them toward each other?
Okay, well, Henry is in his early 30s. He works in an office. I describe him to people as sort of conservative a little bit. He's kind of square, but super nice, and he just wants to succeed in life in the probably most conventional way possible. And he is in a pretty awful situation. His fiance left him. He has a mortgage that he can't afford. So the story starts off with him in a particular financial situation that's common with a lot of people in our economic climate. Danny is sort of the polar opposite. She's in her early 20s. She's a bartender. She rides a 10-speed, doesn't own a car, and she drinks a lot, and she's reckless. But she's brilliant, and she's sort of an early adapter to kidnap to the application. The story opens with Henry, and he's being solicited to work for the company. And I don't want to reveal too much, but throughout the novel, you'll see how Henry and Danny eventually, I don't want to say what happens, but they meet.
They're seduced in different ways and on different ends of this entire network and what it's all about.
Yeah.
There is one other major character, I guess you could say, in this story that I want to have you talk about, and that's the ubiquitous smartphone, right? I mean,
sure.
Henry and Danny, they're both thoroughly addicted to their phones. The phones are constantly intruding and interrupting their lives, controlling their lives, mm-hmm. really. And, of course, this whole kidnap app hinges on everyone having these phones and being constantly plugged into them and the GPS component of them. How much of this story is really kind of a meditation on our relationship with these mobile devices?
I think you really nailed it there, because you are sort of, I don't want to say kidnapped when you're involved with social media, but it is sort of a metaphor. Like, these characters are sucked into this world that's really changing and developing them, but it has everything to do with their cell phones and social media and connectivity.
And in a sense, there's an irony here, because the kidnap app is all about this technology, but the desire to be kidnapped, in a sense, is like people wanting to escape their phones and their connectedness.
Yeah, it's. I guess the twist with the story is that it's totally consensual. So I've taken kidnapping, which is, you know, traditionally a bad thing, and I've turned it upside down and made it a positive thing. To sort of preface a little bit, the waiters that are waiting to be kidnapped, they tailor their kidnappings in such a way that it's not a violent act, and it's not something that is malicious or hurts anyone. It's sort of like what you're saying. It's an escape. Danny in particular, because she's sort of an early adapter, and you get the feeling that she's been using the app for about a year or so, she's developed her takings or kidnappings into something totally more conceptual. She's not just being tied up in a room. There's something more profound happens. And I think that's where the potential for tenderness and vulnerability opens up sort of a traditional plot device into something way more interesting.
Yeah, these kidnapping submissions can be infinitely personalized. The duration of your kidnapping, you choose a safe word. But it really does seem like one of the most exquisite parts of the experience for these people is the time between once they press the submit button and when they actually get nabbed.
Yeah, I wanted to stress that. It's the tension that's created when you hit submit and you have that 48-hour window to be taken. That's where your world is turned upside down because you don't know when you're going to disappear, who's going to take you, how they're going to take you and when, or who's going to see you being taken. And the fact that this could happen, like someone tomorrow could create this app, and if it were approved and put on the market, who's to stop people from doing it? And that was one of the things when I developed the idea of the social network. And when I told people the premise, they were like, well, is it real? Can it be real? And some people want it to be real. Like some readers are like, I would do that.
You're tuned to The Signal on WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin, joined in studio this week by Baltimore author Justin Soroyce. His new book is called So Say the Waiters. And Justin, at one point in your story, we meet the creator, the mastermind of this wildly popular kidnap app, and he says, what do you give a person who has everything? You start taking things away. And I wonder what you intended him to mean by that, what sort of a comment that is about society and how much we have at our fingertips and how much that means to us or ends up not meaning to us.
Yeah. I think in a consumer culture where we have everything at our fingertips, where we can download things at the drop of a hat or go out to a bar or buy a soda at 8 in the morning or 3 in the morning or anytime we want, that there's an allure to taking options away and that people do want to restrain themselves and they have this kind of longing to being told not what to do. And the whole thing with kidnap is building a culture around that type of restraint.
There's something in this story of yours, Justin, that reminds me a lot of Chuck Palahniuk's book Fight Club. You've got these masses of people who are sort of dulled to their existences, and they gravitate to this kind of extreme underground sport of kidnapping just to feel alive again. And it's like a religiously revelatory experience for them. I mean, it seems to hit a strangely modern American nerve, this fantasy. What do you think is behind that impulse?
Everyone's always looking for meaning. I am. I'm not a religious person. I'm not that spiritual. I have art, and that brings meaning to my life. And I think So Say the Waiters sort of taps into this need that people are constantly looking for something higher than themselves. And if someone gives you a vehicle for creating that for yourself, be it religion or art or being a radio host, then that's okay. It's giving you a sense of yourself, and that's what people are always, since the dawn of time, really looking for.
Definitely a pretty universal modern American nerve, but I should say for local Baltimore readers, especially for like current day 20 and 30-something city dwellers, I have to say you evoke a sense of place here that is absolutely uncanny. Certain rock clubs, certain farm-to-table restaurants, you don't mention them all by name, but if you're from around here, you know exactly where these places are and where they've taken from. And then there's this certain vegetarian, tattooed, fixed-gear bike-riding demographic that you manage to sort of simultaneously celebrate and satirically skewer. This is your tribe, if I may venture a guess. This is your Baltimore.
It is. I moved here when I was 18, and I fell in love with, like, the local indie music scene, and I feel like that's how I was sort of brought up as an adult. On the flip side, Henry is he works in a federal agency, and that's my other life. So I'm sort of melding the two together. So I think our other half of the readers might say the same thing about the office culture that I mentioned in the book as well. But I mean, I've been waiting a long time to write about Baltimore and find the right story and the right people and characters, and hopefully this is it.
Let me ask you about the format of this book. This was originally published serially. How does this work? It's in episodes.
Yeah, it's sort of meta in a sense because I literally wanted people to read it on their cell phones, on the Kindle app, which is free, and you can download the first episode, which is a fifth of the book, on your phone or tablet or whatever, and read it on the fly. So I was thinking like, okay, you're reading a book on an app about a cell phone app, and it's just, it references itself. But it's been really handy to serialize the novel because for a dollar, literally, you can get the first episode and check it out. If you don't like it, you don't have to buy the rest. And then the next two episodes are cheap. And then from there on, it's sort of serialized in bits and pieces. The paperback is available as well. But I like the idea of serializing this thing in episodes, also because it's almost written like a TV show.
I was going to say, this is sort of the literary version of one of those super addictive HBO series. And, of course, they all have, like, this cliffhanger ending that makes you immediately want to start reading the next episode.
That's the point. I think my long-term major goal with this is to see it adapted on screen. I would love to see that.
Finally, before I let you go, Justin, I must say I will, after having read this book, never again be able to say the expression cool without feeling like a total bonehead. You have a vendetta against this word, this casual expression, cool. Anytime anyone says the word cool in this book, they immediately feel like an idiot, or someone else thinks they're an idiot for having said it. What's the beef, man? Did you realize you did that?
No. It's so uncool of me.
Every time someone says cool in here, someone, like, that character is immediately like, why did I say that? What a stupid thing to say. Or the character who it's been said to is like, what a moronic thing for this person to say.
Man. That says more about me than you. I don't know.
You're airing some of your own neuroses in this book as well.
Well, I think there's a lot of insecurity in this book that gets solved throughout the series. I have a lot of it outlined. I outlined the entire thing before I started it, and then I have the next 6 through 9 episodes outlined. And Henry and Danny, as insecure and bizarre as they are right now, develop into totally different people by the end of, I'm going to say, the third book. So they get cooler.
Justin Sirois is the author of So Say the Waiters. You can check it out online at sosaythewaiters.com. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like
And that's going to wrap things up for this week's episode of The Signal. We love to hear your thoughts and questions about the program. You can always reach us through our website, WIPR.org, where you'll find on-demand audio and podcasts of the program. We're on Facebook, too, and you can check us out there at Signal Radio Baltimore. The Signal is an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. Our theme music comes to us from Wendell Patrick, and the show is produced by Lisa Morgan and Aaron Hankin. For 88.1 WIPR, your NPR news station, I'm Andy Beanstock. Thanks for listening.